before starting the class again, I will try to continue the discussion that we had in the last Friday discussion on some of the points raised by some students. One question is, we quite often hear you saying in the Friday class that the scriptures only point to the supreme knowledge. The light is always there, and the spiritual practices, study of scriptures, contemplation, and so on, are only for removing the darkness. Yes, this is a very, from a philosophical point of view, even cultural point of view, this is a serious subject. What is the place of book in spiritual life, in religious life? As I mentioned earlier, we have to draw a line of demarcation between religious life and spiritual life. Spiritual life is universal. A spiritual person normally would be very kind, compassionate, broad-minded, not only towards those who belong to his own religious tradition or cultural tradition, but even towards those who are totally opposed to him in religious faith or cultural values. So, true spirituality is a kind of universal spiritual humanism. It accommodates all the essential ethical values of religious traditions, but goes beyond the parameters or the accepted definitions or superstructures of religion. Because normally in sociology and also anthropology and also in theology, when we use the word religion in its conventional usage, I'm not trying to explain it in on the basis of its Latin or Greek root, nothing of the kind. What we normally understand, what we mean when we use the word religion, religion in actual practice, as it is found, not that it ought to be so, but as it is normally found in today's world. Religion very often consists of four important components. A book, a strong book, which is symbolic of theological, canonical tenets and doctrines and dogmas. Faith in a well-defined concept of God. Then, a place of worship, which we associate with the presence of God, or which we consider to be sacred and holy, as different from all other places. That is very important. In fact, to understand spirituality, we must understand what religion is. Then only we will be able to understand what I meant when I said that spirituality goes beyond religions but accommodates all that religion stands for, but still goes far beyond. So first, a book, a belief in a book, a place of worship, and faith in a creator God, in a transcendental moral authority who is responsible for the creation and who looks after all of us, who listens to our prayers, answers our prayers, and so on. And then a set of rituals, practices. On a special day, we go to a place of worship, perform certain rituals, which are mentioned, explained in the canonical, theological literature of the particular religious tradition. Now, Vedanta fully recognizes its value, its relevance, its importance. But Vedanta says that true spirituality is one step beyond this. Because theology has its problems. Theology is often in conflict with philosophy. You can see, if Augustine did not acknowledge some of the universal, I would say, spiritual ideas found in the Neoplatonism, in the works of Plotinus, as we pronounce here, Plotinus, and Philo. Augustine gave a full-fledged structure of Christian theology. Now, what happens? Theology sometimes becomes a limitation. It interprets scriptures, but by interpreting scriptures, theology sometimes creates its own prison walls, dogmas and doctrines, which sometimes limits the scope of a religious tradition to go beyond itself to recognize spirituality. We find all the great mystics the world has seen have something in common: compassion, broad-mindedness, what we call an intense humanism. Not humanism as it is understood in modern political science or sociology, but humanism in a very, very spiritual sense. These are some of the characteristics: love, compassion, mercy, humanism, and so on. These are some of the characteristics that you find in the works and also in the life of great mystics. Call it, you may Kant or St. Francis of Assisi or Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa or Shankaracharya, Vivekananda, in all of them you find. They go beyond the limitations of theology. They go even beyond the limitations of philosophy. And they often speak from the standpoint of experience. Now, here I have tried to give you an idea of the place of scriptures in religion. As I said, scriptures, or rather theology, sometimes becomes even an obstacle in universal spiritual humanism. It helps, of course. Theological studies have produced outstanding mystics, great men of love, great men of God, and men and women of God. No doubt. Some of the greatest mystics were also great scholars in theology. But sometimes theology catches you by the throat when you try to step one inch beyond its own limitations. Now, what is the place of philosophy? Philosophy enables us to rationally interpret and analyze the rationale of theological doctrines. Spirituality reconciles philosophy, theology, and mysticism. Because a truly spiritual person will never unnecessarily criticize any dogma. He may point out its drawbacks, but such a great spiritual person will never criticize any dogma, any doctrine which is good and which is spiritually beneficial for mankind. She may point out its drawbacks. So spirituality reconciles, it effects a reconciliation between theology, philosophy, and mysticism. It recognizes on mysticism, because mysticism always implies experience. Now, all scriptures will help us to understand certain ideas, doctrines, which are important in spiritual life. But understanding or intellectual comprehension of these ideas alone will not give us experience. Experience alone makes us spiritual, not theology, not philosophy. Experience alone makes us spiritual. Experience is the last goal, the final goal of religious life. Now, what I hear, the point is the importance of scriptures. Scriptures are fundamental in religion, but spirituality goes beyond scriptures. Religion, organized religions, well-structured, well-defined religions will never go against theology, against theological doctrines, against the book. Spirituality goes beyond the book. And many of the great spiritual teachers the world has produced have given new light on theological doctrines. It means they went beyond the accepted theological dogmas prevailing during that time. So a book is not a criterion for spiritual life. In fact, one important characteristic of Vedanta is, Vedanta says, you listen to what the book tells you, and then you use your intelligence, and then you should reach experience. All the Upanishads, and Upanishads are the fundamental books which describe Vedanta philosophy. Upanishads themselves tell us, well, the truth is beyond us. All the books belong to secondary knowledge. The primary supreme knowledge is spiritual experience. But it doesn't mean that books are irrelevant, books are unnecessary. Books are necessary. Great spiritual books are a great blessing, because our mind or intellect is always active. We have to feed our mind or intellect with some good food. And religious books, spiritual books are good food for the mind. At least at the intellectual level, our mind is supplied with good food. It becomes spiritually enriched. It becomes purified. And such a mind gradually is able to meditate. And such a mind finally reaches the experience level. So books are necessary, just as light is necessary. But what's the purpose of light? The purpose of light is to remove darkness. All the great religious books, spiritual books, help us by feeding our mind with good thoughts, holy thoughts, spiritual thoughts, which finally influence our actions. Actions of the five senses of perception, and also actions of the five senses of action. If we don't feed our mind with good thoughts, then mind has a tendency to seek its own food, which may be poisonous. What the mind instinctively seeks and often gets may be poison. Because when we open our eyes, we see many things. We also hear many things. And all the senses of perception are projected outward, and they bring sensations to the mind. And many of these sensations may not be healthy for the mind. Many of them may be unhealthy, could be poisonous. So if we do not feed our mind with healthy food, the mind will instinctively seek poisonous, unhealthy, unhygienic food, and it will become sick, it will die. Therefore, books, spiritual practices, taking holy names, pilgrimages, or anything which takes our mind away from undesirable paths and turn towards spiritual ideas is healthy and good. That's the idea behind. So, Here he said, the light is always there, and the spiritual practices, study of scriptures and contemplation on those higher ideas only remove the darkness. It means without contemplation, without study of scriptures, without listening to these ideas, without feeding the mind with holy spiritual thoughts or thoughts which are useful, spiritually useful to our life, without that, how can we meditate? Because the same mind which goes towards external objects and which may feed upon poisonous food has to be turned inward. And with that mind only we have to meditate, and the mind should be slowly drawn away from unhealthy, undesirable objects and should be trained stage by stage and then to turn to a higher level. If we can't read holy scriptures all the time, which holy scriptures sometimes talk about God, some transcendental ideas which may not be empirically very attractive, then better read good sublime poetry. There are many sublime, many great works even in popular literature. The works of Tolstoy or Dostoevsky, with creative writers. If you read a work like Brothers of Karamazov, you cannot help being spiritual. Brothers of Karamazov contains one of the most marvelous masterpieces. The fifth section, you find the Grand Inquisitor episode. So many of these great masters of literature, poetry, painting, art, all of them slowly take our mind away from its lowest level and take it towards higher, maybe not spiritual, but at least intellectual level, aesthetic level. And that mind can again be lifted upward. So books are essential, but books do not constitute the goal of human life. In fact, if you read history of the world, you find there have been more wars and bloodshed in the name of books, in the name of religions, on behalf of God, than atheistic ideas. Maybe in 20th century only we have seen huge national, political, social movements which were atheistic in nature, starting wars and massacres. Till 19th century, you can see the history of the world. So there have been conflicts in the name of books. Books are not responsible. Human mind is responsible. So great masters, great teachers of the world have always proclaimed, we need great holy books, scriptures. We need spiritual practices because that's the royal path towards the higher goal, the supreme goal of life, that is spiritual experience. As I said, experience. Every religious life has 4 levels of evolution that you can find everywhere. Lowest level, ritual. We may perform a ritual mechanically. At the next level, mythology. Stories related to rituals. Third level, philosophy. There are many sublime truths at the philosophical level. But the highest level is experience. It is this experience which actually enables us to graduate from religion to spirituality. That's the main point. Now, that's... And then there are a few more questions. If the samskaras means natural tendencies that constitute our character. What we are is nothing but certain natural tendencies that we have inherited or acquired. Inherited, according to Vedanta, from previous lives, or acquired in this life. So they constitute what we actually are, other than the physical mechanism. So if the samskaras accumulated through various births direct character and personality or behavior of a person, when there are personality conflicts or friction in work relationships, could we say that it's only one set of samskaras fighting against the other. Ultimately, the answer is yes. But it doesn't mean that we are helpless toys in the hands of samskaras. We are totally helpless. Of course, conflicts are mentioned. Many modern psychiatrists, not just parapsychologists who are not recognized by psychologists proper, mainstream psychologists, but many psychiatrists, some of them are mainstream psychologists, do admit that there must be something that we may call inherited tendencies not related to this life, which are responsible for some problems like schizophrenia and multiple personality. So, multiple personality can only be explained in the light of conflicting samskaras or tendencies that we have acquired from previous life. That's a view of some eminent psychologists. Not all the mainstream psychologists may agree. But Vedanta says that whenever you find that there is a tendency in a person that you cannot explain in the light of his or her experiences in this life, that a hypnotist may not be able to fully explain by taking the patient's mind towards the years of memory formation, then those tendencies can be traced to previous life. That's what Vedanta says. Because there are certain tendencies that we do not know where they come from. In Sanskrit, it is called anusruta sabhava. Anusruta means something which flows continuously from previous life. Now, could we say that it is only one set of samskaras fighting against the other? It is true. But then, these samskaras are not tyrants, and we are not helpless slaves in the hands of the samskaras. That if we believe that we are helpless slaves or tools in the mighty hands of samskaras who are tyrants, then we become fatalists. And that's the end of spirituality. So, it doesn't justify fatalism or belief in fatalism if we are today, because of what we did yesterday, means if our present life is the result of what we did in the previous life, then we can certainly, by the same logic, we can effect a change in our future by doing good things. Now, what are these tendencies and samskaras? I think they need some explanation. I shall try to explain. Okay, now, see, for example, some of you are walking through the San Francisco streets. When you walk from here to the Bay Area, you may meet many people whom you do not know. You may see vehicles, and you may also see pebbles, stones, and dry leaves, and so many things. After returning home, you don't remember the faces of people. You don't remember the vehicles that you saw. You don't remember the leaves and grass and the pebbles or stones that you saw lying in the street. But suppose while walking, you know, San Francisco is full of dogs. Suppose one dog breaks out of chain and chases you. You may remember that at least for some days. So anything that has an intensity of experience will automatically register its memory. At this stage, it is only memory. Memory has not become samskaras right now. Memory is not samskaras. At this time, at this stage, it is only memory. Suppose you have a hairbreadth escape from an accident or something. you get frightened. That also perhaps you may remember. If it is a pleasant experience, that also you may remember. Any positive or negative experience which has got an intensity, you remember. Why? Because you are consciously becoming a witness of that incident. When you do something, when we do something consciously, when we are an actor involved in that action, in the process, when we are involved as an actor, when we are deliberately doing something, that action produces a memory. And if that action is repeated, or if a single action itself is very intense, it can become a very deep-rooted memory. And it can even determine our behavior. So somebody who was chased by a dog and maybe bitten when he or she was a child may be shy of facing dogs and walking in the streets. But because, of course, that is explained by any modern psychologist will explain that. Now, what about tendencies and samskaras which cannot be explained in the light of any experience in this life? By the same logic, there should be something which should explain these inexplicable tendencies and samskaras. They come from previous life. Now, if you have done some intense spiritual practice, maybe 50 lives before, centuries before, and if the samskaras are still there within, when we pass in front of a temple or a church or any place of worship where spiritual practices are going on, we have a natural tendency to enter that place, depending upon the power or the intensity of its opposite tendencies. That's all. There are so many variants in this. So there are good tendencies and bad tendencies. Bad tendencies, when they become stronger, they may suppress good tendencies. That's how people sometimes go astray in life. When good tendencies are strong, positive, spiritually useful tendencies are strong, when they become dominant, then they move, they take us in that direction. In Gita, I can quote one verse and explain. I already quoted in the last class Arjuna's question. Arjuna was asking a question. What happens to a person who starts spiritual life? Maybe not for a long time, maybe just for half an hour, or 1 or 2, 3 days, may have listened to some spiritual talk, may have meditated, or may have read some holy sublimating book, but then forgot. That man dies. Or somebody, another person who practiced spirituality, who did a lot of spiritual practice throughout his life or her life, but then a slight deviation to his end of life. All this happened. What happens to such a person? Arjuna's question is everything gone and lost? Is the devil waiting at the gate of hell? Just because somewhere something went wrong. So heaven denied? Does it mean that we have to go to hell? Everything is lost. Krishna says no, nothing will be lost. You put money in the bank, it becomes yours. If not today, tomorrow, you can draw your check. Similarly, any little spiritual practice, even a good action of helping an old lady, an old man waiting on the one side of the street, you help him or her to cross the street, a noble act, that also will have its useful benefit, spiritual benefit. It will become an account in our name, in the bank, spiritual bank. So Krishna gives clue to the mechanism by which this works. തത്രതം ബുദ്ധി സംയോഗം ലഭതേ പൗർവദേഹികം യദതേച തതോ ഭൂയ സംസിദ്ധോ കുരുനന്ദന. ഇറ്റ്സ് എ വേഴ്സ്, യു ഫൈൻഡ് ദിസ് വേഴ്സ് ഇൻ ദ സിക്സ്ത് ചാപ്റ്റർ ഓഫ് ദി ഗീത. സോ ഇറ്റ് ഈസ് കോൾഡ് ധ്യാനയോഗ ഓർ ധ്യാത്മയോഗ ആൻഡ് സോൺ. ഐ ഓൾറെഡി എക്സ്പ്ലെയിൻഡ് അതർ വേഴ്സസ് വിച്ച് ഇൻക്ലൂഡ് കൃഷ്ണാസ് ആൻസർ ആൻഡ് ജുനാൻസ് ക്വസ്റ്റ്യൻ ആൻഡ് സോൺ. ഹിയർ ലോർഡ് കൃഷ്ണ സേസ് ഇൻ നെക്സ്റ്റ് ലൈഫ് വാട്ട് ഹാപ്പൻസ്, this buddhi, this mind which has accumulated some good tendencies, either by helping a poor old man to cross the street in a busy street, or helping a homeless person financially, or educating children, or maybe reading the Bible or the Gita or any holy book regularly for some days, or meditating maybe only once in your life, all days remain in the spiritual bank. All these good noble deeds have left a strong, they have registered a strong memory, a tendency, which is called samskara. This tendency of samskara, it is already put in the bank account. Then what happens in the next life? When you are born again, this same bundle, this bundle of conflicting tendencies and samskaras are transferred to the next life. It's like some kind of a relay, 400 meters relay, 1000 meters relay, you know, you have to change the baton has to be changed. So the huge bundle of samskaras and tendencies are again carried over to the next life. This bag contains conflicting samskaras and tendencies. Many of them are good, many of them are bad. It could be so. If a person has done 99%, 95% good deeds, she may be born in a family of spiritual seekers, where the family atmosphere, the situation prevailing, the family setting itself will be conducive to spiritual life. Otherwise, he or she may be born in a different, ordinary background. Now, sometimes we may forget these tendencies. We forget, you know. But then suddenly we may remember when we take a good book from a library, a book that tells us of spiritual life, a book that tells that this worldly life is a matter of 2-3 minutes, they are not eternal. There is something beyond enjoying sensory pleasures. There is higher spiritual goal. There is a higher spiritual dimension to human personality. If you happen to read such a book while going to library, suddenly it catches you. Why? Because you have done some good spiritual practice in previous life. You may not be in last life, maybe previous life somewhere. So when you go to library, when you read this book, suddenly it catches you. Many people read books, they are not caught. People spend days and years reading action thrillers, which may help them to forget the reality of life around. It's not very different from drinking alcoholic drugs or anything like that, drinks or drugs, whatever may be. Because people want to run away from themselves. Most people who take to these wrong means, they want to run away from themselves. They want to run away from surroundings. They want to create an artificial world around them, a world which is different from the world of realities. So they want to forget themselves. But some people, in the midst of all this, when they suddenly happen to read this holy books, suddenly they are caught. And then they see where that book is published, and they may find out the address or website and go in search of such places where they participate in meditation program or spiritual practices. How does this happen? Because these positive, spiritually helpful samskaras are suddenly coming to the surface. They establish this connection. So, which means our constant effort should be directed towards enriching, increasing positive samskaras. For that we need deliberate and conscious effort. All the time one may not be able to spend reading or meditation. But whenever time permits, at least for a beginner, you add some spiritual food to our mind. Give some spiritual food to our mind. So you find mind slowly lift itself above the mundane empirical level. The last question, and with this we will conclude this particular session. If we say, I am propelled by my samskaras, how does developing willpower or consciously changing the samskaras to become better or sattvic come into the picture? This is what I have explained. So, whatever means are available, wherever, somehow or other we must increase the good samskaras, good tendencies. This is what Vedanta says. And Vedanta doesn't say you should read one particular book or you should practice one particular religion, nothing of the kind. Vedanta is an all-inclusive one. Anybody, whatever religion she or he may belong to, or cultural tradition she or he may belong to, whatever that person chooses, that can be his or her path. Vedanta even opens its doors to non-believers. If a person leads a spiritual life, humanistic spiritual life, that is also Vedantic way of life. So I think I have tried to explain all the questions that were raised. Of course, we won't have class next Friday, 29th, because of Thanksgiving holiday. So if you want to ask any more questions, either related to this or different questions, independent questions, you are welcome to raise your points. Any point that you want me to explain again, any point that's not clear, not made clear enough?
During the Renaissance in Christianity, there was quite a debate about the presence or whether or not one had free will.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Because we can improve our future, improve our lot by doing good deeds. There is free will. But then we cannot get out of the tendencies that we have already accumulated. So there is free will, but again, people often misuse their free will. So they accumulate tendencies and impressions, samskaras, which eventually limit that free will, which binds them. That's what really happens. So Vedanta fundamentally believes in free will. In fact, the balance is in favor of free will. See, Vivekananda said in one context, it's a great statement in his speech. He made that statement in America. It was highly appreciated. He said, if you want, you can be saint this moment. He made a statement. It's something very interesting. There have been saints and sages in the past. You also can become a saint. And if you want, you can become a saint this moment. What does it mean? But we may take a strong determination it doesn't always happen. Often, there is always a determination and action. There's a gap between what we determine to do and what we actually do. But this gap can be narrowed by intense practice. Because intellect decides, determines, uses free will, and mind does. It is mind that fundamentally decides what we do, not intellect. Intellect may have so many good ideas about doing good things. But when we really try to do, we fail because we often live at mental level, not intellectual level. So how to bridge this gap? Through constant practice. That's what Vedanta. What's the recommendation which Vedanta gives? Examples could be found. I can give the example of one great saint who happened to be the first poet in Sanskrit language. The first poem was Ramayana. It contains nearly 24,000 verses. If you call, you may have to put it somewhere in the 3rd millennium BC or even earlier. Its author was born in a family of very difficult conditions, and he became a robber. He became a robber, and his job was mostly going about waylaying people, kill them and loot them and rob them. That was his job. He was a robber, professional robber. So once it so happened that one day he found a group of old bearded men passing through the street. They were all sages and saints and sages who were living in hermitages, in the forest hermitages. They were hermits. So this man, the robber, approached them and asked them to give to him whatever they possessed. They didn't have much to to give, of course. But the robber tried to be violent. Then one of the sages, one of the four sages, asked him one question. Well, we are ready to give you whatever you want, whatever we have. But could you answer one question? For whom are you doing all this work? For who asked you to go about robbing people, taking their money and their possessions? He said he's a poor man, he has wife and children, and he has to support them. Then they asked him, do you know that if you do all these evil deeds, perhaps you may have to suffer. Police may catch you, the king's policemen may catch you, or you may have to suffer after your death for whatever karmas, actions you are doing. Do you think your wife and children or the relatives for whose sake you are indulging in these criminal activities, they will share you? They will join you in when you go to hell, they will join you there. Go and ask them. The man was, he's a simple man. He went and asked his mother first. Now look here, I'm my job. You know how I'm able to give you food 3 times a day? How I'm able to support you? Do you know my real job, my profession? Mother said, I don't know. And he explained. The mother was aghast. She was shocked. You fellow, you evil man, what are you doing? So you won't join me in hell when I'm going there? Now how can I join you in hell? Who asked you to rope to do all these wicked deeds? He asked his wife, his children, and all the relatives. They all scolded him, cursed him for indulging these criminal, violent activities. Robbing and murdering people and taking away their possessions. And this fellow returned to the sages. And he said, no, I asked my relatives for all this. whether they will share my fate. They said no. Now what should I do? I don't want to continue this life the way I'm living now. I want to change my course of life. Then they tried to give him a holy name. But he was such a rustic and he has done only evil deeds in his life. He could not utter that sacred name. The name they tried to teach him was Rama. Rama is the name of God in conversion into religion. That fellow could not utter that name. So they reversed it. Mara, can you utter? That day, Ma-ra. That he could do. And they asked him to utter this rapidly. So it became Rama. So consciously he could not do that because of his evil tendencies and impressions that formed his character. He could not bring himself to utter the sacred name even once. You make any sacred name, it could be any religious tradition, it works the same. And so then they taught him to pronounce this name in reverse. And they asked him, you sit here, you chant this name, and don't go away before we return. And this man stayed there. For years and years he uttered the sacred name. And finally, a huge anthill formed around him. After several years, the same team of sages came that way. They found a huge anthill. They knew that it was their man, the robber, who was obediently, devotedly chanting the holy name. And they broke the anthill and they found an old bearded man sitting. And he was immersed in meditation, chanting the holy name. So they woke him up. He became the first great poet of Sanskrit literature. It's called Valmiki. Valmiga means anthill. So a great sage who meditated inside an anthill. That's what his name. Now just imagine what made him obey the words of the sage. He was a simple man. A shrewd fellow would not have gone to them again. When the wives and children and mother, other relatives told him, you are doing something very wicked, we won't share your evil destiny, the effect of the result of the evil deeds you are doing, we won't share them. It is your duty to share. You did that, so you have to bear the fruit of it. So he was a simple man, so he went straight to them and told them, well, this was what my relatives told. They said they won't share my fate. So what should I do? So they taught him this sacred mantra, sacred holy name. Now the man was very simple. He was willing to intensely believe in what they said. So this simplicity of mind gives a lot of intensity. So simplicity of heart is a great help. If a person has got that kind of will, where the mind, word and deed all come in one straight line, when a person decides to say what he is going to do and do what he says and thinks what he says and does, when we reach that level of intensity and integrity, then willpower is enough for one to become a saint, to start a new life, any point. But again, the accumulated tendencies can create problems. This kind of willpower is not possible for everyone. So willpower is... You see, Saint Francis of Assisi is another example, of course. He was a knight. He was a soldier. He became a saint. So it's another classic example where one man uses his willpower to become a saint. You can find the lives of many great saints. In the lives of all these great mystics who were men and women of God, one important characteristic that you find in their life is that they were men and women of strong willpower. See, a weak man or woman with weak will, without a strong will, can never be good, never be spiritual. Spiritual life needs a very, very strong iron will. Iron will is not only necessary in material life, but in spiritual life also. In fact, in spiritual life, it is much more necessary. I would tell, in the Gita, in the 12th chapter, Lord Krishna gives the characteristics of great devotees, great spiritual men and women. He says, Sandushta Satatam Yogi Yatatma Dridanischeha. First one is, he should be always in a happy mood. Not happiness in his very shallow sense. In a state of such a great devotee, will be always in a blissful mood because he feels the presence of God everywhere. He has perfect control. And then he should have a strong iron will. There is one word in Sanskrit that is used, Dridanischeha, means a person of strong determination. It comes in the 12th chapter. So, a strong willpower, a strong will, is the essential characteristic of all great spiritual persons. Look at Buddha, look at Christ, look at Sri Ramakrishna, Shankaracharya, Vivekananda, or any great man, anywhere. Wherever you find great spiritual personalities, spiritual men and women, who reached the peak of spiritual life, you find they had a strong willpower. So, willpower plays a very important role in spiritual life.
How does Vedanta recommend to build willpower that wavers? How does Vedanta recommend to strengthen willpower that wavers?
Oh, yes. Well, there are different methods. One method is to get the mind acquainted with these ideas. Second method is, you know, you look at the world. In fact, our mind wavers mostly because the fleeting joys, objects of pleasure attract us. That's why mind wavers. Wavering of mind is directly related to changing desires and changing moods and attitudes. If we can just keep in mind that the world that we are living in is always in a flux, it's always changing. Behind this changing universe, there is one changeless reality, that is Atman. So this identity, I am the Atman, this is this identity, this, it may not have reached the experience level, but even intellectual understanding that I am something that goes beyond the psychophysical mechanism. I am something beyond this body, beyond the senses, beyond all this. And the eternal reality. That, if we can constantly meditate and focus on this thought, mind becomes strong. Looking at the world, we can never be strong-willed. We can be strong-willed for secular purposes, of course. A person of strong desire. If we read Dale Carnegie's Public Speaking and Making Friends in Business, he also speaks about the need for willpower. How to succeed, all these books you find. How to make millions of dollars. They also need willpower. But here I'm speaking something more about spirit, the willpower in spiritual life. So in spiritual life, to save our mind from temptations, one method is that God or spiritual knowledge is the only unchanging reality in this world. That's one way to keep our mind ourselves focused on that. If we can remind ourselves of this truth, mind becomes steady. You are right, you know, we have to experience it to reach the highest spiritual willpower, which a Buddha and others had. But that experience may not be easily available for a beginner. Slowly we had to lift our mind to a higher and higher level. So one way is to keep our mind constantly acquainted with these ideas. Because mind has a tendency to come into terms with what is available around it. That's its nature. Whatever presents itself to the mind is drawn towards this. So if we can constantly feed our mind with positive spiritual ideas, that's one way to keep a mind, to develop a spiritual willpower. It could be done through meditation, by reading, by listening, even by sitting, thinking on good thoughts, these ideas. I was here talking about developing willpower in spiritual life, of course. That's what I was talking about. So, then today we will conclude. Today, of course, it is already 8:29:30. If you have any more questions, we have just a few more minutes. Otherwise, we'll conclude. Any points to be discussed? Yes, when we live in society, engaging different activities, professional activities, how to develop these positive tendencies? That's the question?
Yes.
Okay. One method is to give a positive direction to our mind. Now, mind is a subtle mechanism. How does mind connect itself to the external world? Through eyes, it sees things. Through ears, it hears things. Through touch, through smell, and so these are the five, you know, through touch, smell, and then by taste. These are the five methods by which these five senses of perception connect the mind with the external world. Now, mind is naturally drawn towards the external world. And mind gets scattered because the objects in the external world are manifold. Thus, this variety itself is bewildering, so mind sometimes gets distracted. Now, one method is to divert our senses of perception towards creative channels. I already indicated earlier. So use our eyes to see things that may be helpful in creating healthy willpower in spiritual life. Because eyes often see many things and may bring to the mind unhealthy visual tendencies and impressions. So also ears. So all the five senses of perception have a tendency to bring unhealthy thought currents and tendencies and samskaras towards the mind. And if we do not try to control the activities of the senses of perception, there is a chance that mind may get polluted and it becomes highly disturbed. So conflicts and anxiety, all these. When we work in an office, anxiety is natural. conflicts are natural. How to work without anxiety. For that, Vedanta gives one important prescription. Technically, it is known as Karma Yoga. The method is this. Just whatever we do, whatever work, including your professional duties, try to do this work without any strong attachment. It doesn't mean that we should be indifferent or negligent or lethargic. Not at all. If we believe in God, we can look upon whatever we do as an act of worship. Worship can be done not only in a place of worship, but also in an office place where we are working, where we are engaging daily professional duties and responsibilities. In the broad field of workplace also, we can practice religion and spirituality by looking upon every act as an act of worship without any sense of bargaining behind it, without any strong desire or motive. Because when we have a strong desire or motive or attachment, it creates anxiety when we are already engaged in work. And if the work doesn't produce the expected result, it could produce its opposite reaction, depression, disappointment. So one method which Vedanta prescribes is, whatever we do, do as an act of God, act of worship. This is a very simple practice. One can do that. Because when we combine action with an attitude of worshipfulness, we never become indifferent or negligent. If we use the word detachment, sometimes it could be interpreted as negligence or indifference. With all enthusiasm, with all great care, we must engage in our duties and responsibilities, which will naturally produce expected result. But as an attitude of worshipfulness. If we can work like this, we can work without anxiety. And when we do not work with anxiety, when we work without any anxiety, we are able to focus much more energy and concentration on what we are doing. Because anxiety takes away a lot of mental energy. It causes distraction of mind. If there is no anxiety, there is no distraction, and there is complete concentration, and the work becomes successful. This is one way to practice spirituality. So spirituality is not something to be practiced in a place of worship or when we meditate or when we pray. Spirituality is something that we practice every moment of our life in everything that we do. This is one of the several methods that Vedanta prescribes, which anyone can practice. So we conclude now. If you have got any points to be discussed, you are most welcome. You can hand over your questions perhaps to the desk that end. You can give to me at the end of the class if you want, and we will answer them in the next class. If you cannot raise the question in the class itself, left to your choice. So there is one announcement. We will not have class next Friday, November the 29th, because of the Thanksgiving holiday. The next class will be on Friday, December the 6th. Thank you. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om. Sit down. Namaste.